Welcome to Plain Talk. Plain Talk has over 120 podcasts containing information about aviation technologies and pilot experiences for general and business aviation, from home to cockpit to boardroom to personal tech. Plain Talk provides information for pilots, industry insiders, and aviation enthusiasts alike. My name is Phil Lightstone. I'm a general aviation pilot with over 2,200 hours in my logbook, flying almost every week with over 30 years' experience in the technology, telecommunications, and aviation industries. Well, I'd like to welcome into the Plain Talk cockpit a very cool guy, Charles Chuck Wright. Charles is affectionately known as Chuck. I got to know Chuck when he owned a Rockwell Commander 112. Welcome to the Plain Talk cockpit, Chuck.
Hello, Bill. I hope you can hear me okay.
I hear you 5x5. Yeah.
Okay.
So I think I seem to recall you mentioning you started flying in 2017. What made you decide to become a pilot?
Well, I always wanted to. I started when, obviously, like a lot of, not obviously, but like a lot of kids, when I was 20 years old, got about 4 or 5 hours in a plane, got the solo, and then life kind of got in the way and never did the ground school and kind of dropped away. And back in 2017, a good friend of mine, sailing buddy, took me to Sun and Fun. And I immediately got hooked. I went on a demo ride in several different airplanes and decided then to buy an airplane. So I bought a 1998 Sky Arrow.
In those short 5 years, you've put like 750 hours into your logbook.
Yes, I put probably... And it was an interesting story because the Sky Arrow is not a really well-known airplane. It's mostly known for being modified for teaching handicapped people that don't have use of their legs.
Oh.
And it's still being used for that, actually. And I believe in some university is using it to do that sort of thing. But yeah, I put like 450 hours on the Sky Arrow.
Wow.
To the point where I was even asked by the dealer to fly a brand new Sky Arrow to Oshkosh from Denver. So, and I actually did that. It was pretty neat.
That must have been quite the trip, to say the least.
It certainly was.
While just so that the folks aren't misled, you did mention the Sky Arrow was designed for disabled people. You're not a disabled person yourself.
No.
That sounded pretty cool. And then you jumped in to a Commander.
Well, actually, there was a short period of time. In 2017, I also purchased with the same fund that got me into flying. I bought a helicopter, Rotaway helicopter, and learned to get almost got my helicopter rating. I have about 17 hours in a helicopter.
Wow. You really decided to go full bore, as they say, into aviation.
Yeah.
Wow. And then you jumped into the Commander 112. What made you pick a 112 as your next airplane?
Actually, back when I was in my 20s, that was sort of my favorite airplane. I mean, I absolutely loved the looks of the Commander, and really wanted one. And there was one came up for sale, and it was very well equipped. And I went out and bought it. And put a bunch of hours on the Commander and flew all over the country, and it was a lot of fun.
And I think you attended most during that time most of the commander owner groups get-togethers?
I did.
Got to know all the folks, as they say.
I did. It was very good. I still have really good friends to the commander. I actually attended the commander fly-in this past year.
Neat. Present company included, of course.
Exactly.
And then after the commander, you jumped into 1958 Aranca Tri-Traveler.
That's correct.
Completely different airplane.
Completely different. Yes, I wanted to go back. I really enjoyed the Sky Arrow because it was a stick airplane, and you really could feel it. And I can equate this with sailboat racing. I'm an avid sailboat racer, and I could always find in a very lightweight, high performance sailboat is when you can actually feel how to properly trim the sailboat. And so I sort of got the same sort of feelings with the airplanes. The Sky Arrow was very light, and it was very maneuverable, and you really got to understand, stalls and when the wing's not operating the way it's supposed to be. And it was just a very good feel of what the airplane is doing. And I kind of wanted to get back to that. And this Aranca Champ really, or Tri-Traveler actually has those same features.
Very cool. And then I understand more recently you just picked up a Vans RV3.
Yes, that's my next my next area to explore is actually trying to get into some limited aerobatics.
So a new adventure for you.
Yeah.
And I think just to remind the audience, that's a single seat tail dragger, aerobatic, 210-knot airplane.
Yes, I think the never exceed is like 207 knots.
Wow.
But, it from what I understand, and from I'm being forewarned to, it's an airplane that you have to pay attention to not giving it full throttle on a straight and level flight because you can actually reach that never exceed limit.
Wow. Do you have any aerobatic experience?
When I first took my lessons back when I was 20 years old, I was fortunate enough to I had a female instructor. I forget her name, but I actually took the 7 or 8 hours that I had was in a aerobatic Cessna 150. And so I had very limited, that was like 50 years ago, but I have signed up for a aerobatics course with Patty Wagstaff down here in Florida.
Oh, I think that's a great first step so that, you know what the box looks like and you know what recovery looks like, and you're not trying to teach it yourself in a single seat airplane.
Yes, I very much intend to take this very cautiously and not push the limit.
I can certainly see you in an inverted Lamschewak. folks are probably scratching their head. What the heck's an inverted Lamschewak? What's a Lamschewak? So are you going to, just for safety reasons, are you going to wear a parachute?
I know the regulations state that you're supposed to. And I'm not going to get into this. When I first start flying the RV3, it probably will not be with a parachute, and it will probably be no aerobatics until I get to that point. But I believe when you're actually doing training in aerobatics, you do wear a parachute. I'm actually not familiar totally with what the regulations are on that.
Yeah, I think at least up here in Canada, to do aerobatics, you have to have a parachute. I chatted with parachute manufacturers and riggers historically, and one thing that they just impressed upon me is you always, always, always want to put your parachute on the ground, not in the cockpit. There was an instance where one of their clients would routinely just buckle up in the cockpit, and sadly, during an incident with the aircraft and at altitude, and he hadn't buckled up and exited the aircraft with the parachute in still in the aircraft, and it's like a Wile E. Coyote kind of move, right? So horrible.
Yeah,
but I think if I was flying an RV3 and I was going to do aerobatics, I'd want to be completely consistent every flight, whether it's aerobatic or not. I've got my parachute on, just in case you have a, God forbid, an engine fire or electrical fire or something bad in the cockpit.
Yeah, it is interesting, and I've been, you know, and I like to research things also and get my background nailed down before I try doing things. But one of the things that I've actually been trying to find information on is actual people that have had to exit an airplane, because I can't imagine it's very easy to do.
Yeah, I think you should call up Sean Tucker, because I think with all the aerobatics he's done, he's been very vocal about how many times he's exited the aircraft with this parachute.
Really? I'll have to get his name and number when we get out of this.
But yeah, that's a great point. Have you ever skydived before?
I have skydived, yes.
Oh, so you know how to exit the airplane.
You know, well, it's real easy when it has a big garage door in the back of the airplane.
And the garage door is open.
And the garage door is open, yeah. And, you know, planes like gliders, I know there's been many examples of that, but those things have, you know, canopies that eject, you know, that you can actually jettison the canopy. And so I can understand that being a bit easier. But with like this RV3 has a swing open canopy, so I'm not quite sure how that would respond. You know, I maybe this comes from me being a scientist. I like to look at the big picture. So not just putting the parachute on, but what you actually have to do to exit the airplane.
Now hopefully the RV3 has a canopy jettison latch built in.
It doesn't.
Really? I guess that's going to be your first mod.
If there is a mod, that's one of the things I haven't found is a mod
really?
To do that. There is a build that has the canopy that can slide open.
Right.
And that, see that being able to function, but in any case.
I guess the good news with it being an experimental home built aircraft, you get to design your own mod, install it, and
that's a good point. The other thing that I'm in contact with is the BRS parachutes. They have started making those for the vans aircraft, and I will look into fitting the airplane with that, as long as the weight capacity doesn't exceed the weight limits of the aircraft.
You know, I was always curious because I think the BRS parachute fixes a optics problem, which is when you're heading out, you know, with some friends, passengers to your Commander 112, and you're carrying your personal parachute, and they're looking at you going, Chuck, where's mine? Oh, yeah, sorry, yeah. It wasn't in the budget.
Yeah,
whereas the folks, you know, the BRS folks that have their chutes and Cirruses, and I think there's retrofit kits for 172s and 182s, and bunch of other airplanes, the whole airplane comes down under a chute. But I think probably doing a quick mod to your own, a jettison mod, is going to be way more cost effective than slapping a BRS chute into the whole airplane.
Possibly so. But like I said, I haven't gotten that far yet. And before I start any aerobatics, and one of the things I have checked into is that the RV3 is an exceptional airplane to fly just under normal category limitations. And that will be a huge learning experience for me to begin with anyway.
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's you know, obviously significantly faster than the Commander.
Yeah.
And the Commander's not rated for aerobatics, so to be able to do loops and rolls and Lamshavaks and split S's.
Not unless you're Bob Hoover.
Unless you're bought, well, yeah. Folks, Chuck is talking about this cool video, Bob Hoover flying a Rockwell Commander 114 in the aerobatics category and rolling it and looping it. So you've had kind of an interesting journey at a couple of airports looking to build your own hangar.
Yes. I purchased a hangar in Taunton, Massachusetts. And it, unbeknownst to me, you know, not being, you know, just new into aviation, I never realized that the even though you buy the hangar and you own the building, you don't necessarily own the land that it's on. And so this one hangar, when it as it turns out, this one hangar that I purchased was the land that is leased from the city for this hangar was coming up for renewal after 20 years. Hmm. And so not realizing that this, you know, you could basically lose your investment if you don't get your lease renewed. And so that was an issue in Taunton, Massachusetts, where getting the lease renewed to the point where it was still, you know, cost effective and they weren't the city wasn't trying to you know, basically take your hangar by not renewing your lease. Hmm. So I've learned a lot about that, and I've also learned that in many other states, North Carolina, Florida, Georgia, that this has been a common theme in the United States, where the cities are actually trying to acquire the ownership of the hangars that have been purchased and built by, you know, private owners. And so this seems to be a common theme. And wow. So it has been an uphill struggle.
So in your case in Taunton, does that mean if you're not able to renegotiate the land lease, the building that you bought, the hangar you bought, transitions over to the city for free? Like, they don't have a requirement to make you whole for the cost of the hangar?
That's correct. That's correct.
So they get free buildings. Not cool.
That's correct. And this is something that was sort of put into effect, or sort of suggested, I should say, by the FAA, that municipal airports govern their FBOs and their commercial buildings that are on their lease, that are on the airports, that they have this built-in reversionary clause, which basically states that at the end of the lease, the building goes over to the city that owns the airport.
Wow.
And so as a way of controlling what happens to the airport down the road. And this works fine for a commercial FBO building, because they can build their prices to basically pay for that building over the course of the 20 years, and it doesn't really matter to them. But that's not the case for general aviation owners that want to just keep their airplane in their own garage, per se.
Well, it's a complete cost, as opposed to, as you said, the FBO is adding more revenue through increased fuel rates, maintenance rates, parking rates, hangarage rates, etc. What was it like going through that negotiation with the Taunton city folks?
We actually enlisted help from the AOPA. I forget the person's name, but he assists, you know, property owner or tenants and general aviation questions and things like that. He actually came to the came for a talk at our airport and basically was trying to just say, well, you just got to work with the city and try to work with the political end of things and get things changed to the point where they can understand where you're coming from, and to promote general aviation is good for the city and is good for general aviation also. And this airport doesn't have any commercial entities. It has one A&P shop on it, but it doesn't really have many commercial entities on the airport. So general aviation is the mainstay of keeping the airport alive. So we tried several different methods, and there was just a couple people on the airport commission that were steadfast in terms of putting the airport in a direction not favorable to general aviation. So basically, the bottom line is I had to work really hard on the political side to get the mayor to basically replace those individuals that were causing issues or causing the conflict at the airport. And that finally happened, and we finally resolved everything, and the airport is very successful now, and things have turned the corner. We've signed a new lease. It gives us 220-year terms for the lease, and all is well.
And you actually went into some extraordinary steps to help the mayor down that road by deciding during an election year to run for mayor yourself.
I did, and it sort of put a big emphasis on how important this particular topic was. It made it a sort of a campaign issue in which it really caused the mayor to pay attention to what was happening, you know, so that she could actually become reelected. So it worked out well. I mean, it solved the it's hard to say what happens, but all I know is everything turned a corner within 2 months after I put my name and got the public backing to run for mayor. So whether or not it's because of that, it certainly certainly appears like that was the case.
Well, Chuck, that's really thinking outside of the box. I think we all have to applaud you for your can-do attitude.
And then on top of that, it's actually had an effect globally because I'm not 100% sure it's been the root cause, but I'm undergoing similar things happening in South Florida in putting forth to the airport commissioner, airport manager rather, and the city in Florida about the positive effect that this had in Massachusetts. We just recently was able to have them change their leases for general aviation to give 3 30-year terms for leasing the land, which makes it now you can come down here and build a hangar, and it can be an investment, not necessarily a handicap or a liability or a deductible item, because there's becoming such a demand for hangars.
So are you planning on building more hangars? And
we're under negotiation right now, and actually today is the day that we're supposed to find out if the city has accepted our proposal for leasing the land to build a hangar. And so, yes, if all works out, that's my plan.
Not only were you for some period of time an airplane fleet owner, it sounds like you're going to be a hangar baron.
Well, it is the hardest thing about, you know, you can go out and buy an airplane, but it is, as you probably know, in Canada, it's really, really hard to find places to put these things.
Well, having gone through, on a personal note, losing an airport that was built in the late 50s and trying to find homes for roughly 250 to 300 airplanes in the greater Toronto area. Yeah, there's like not enough airports, not enough hangars, too many airplanes, and it's a big challenge.
Well, there's never too many airplanes.
No, that's true. You can't have too many, but it is a big challenge, and it'll certainly be interesting to see how the, you know, local airports are going to deal with the whole electric airplane phenomena as it starts to gain a little momentum, and how the municipalities or the privately owned airports are going to invest capital to facilitate the electric infrastructure needed for those airplanes.
Yeah, I think those will be the turning of the tables when it comes to commuter type, you know, aviation is when you can start using electric airplanes. I know there's a lot of talk against that, but.
Oh, I think that the whole air taxi environment that currently is utilizing GA aircraft running 100 LOLED, this becomes an interesting political win, at least from an EPA perspective, to migrate off of fossil fuel to clean energy, if you will, powered airplanes. And there's certainly been a lot of development in that world. So with all that said, what's on the horizon, Chuck?
For me, trying to learn how to fly this RV3 and to see if I can become fairly successful in understanding how to do, you know, your basic barrel rolls and that sort of thing. I'm sort of excited to get up to St. Augustine and fly in a extra 300.
Oh, that will be really fun, no doubt. And especially if you're able to go up with Patty Wagstaff. She's such a phenomenal pilot.
She sure is, yeah.
Well, Chuck, thank you so much for being part of the Plane Talk podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you, Phil.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Plane Talk. If you have any ideas for a future Plane Talk episode, please go to the Contact Us page at planetalk.ca and send in your idea. Don't forget to like us at planetalk.ca, our Facebook and LinkedIn pages, and this podcast. And never stop living the dream.